This is a special presentation from 90.5 WESA. On Tuesday, September 18th, WESA held a community forum on school choice. The forum was held at the Pittsburgh Community Broadcast Center on the South Side, and it was moderated by WESA's Christopher Ayers. The public was invited to attend and participate in this discussion. Tonight, WESA presents that conversation. It was edited for Time.
The issue we're here to discuss tonight, school choice, is really a broad topic of discussion. It encompasses public charter schools, private schools, public money being used to send children to private schools, whether that be in the form of vouchers or through educational savings accounts, scholarship programs that we have here in the Commonwealth funded by programs like the Educational Improvement Tax Credit to send children to private schools, homeschooling. The list goes on, and the answer, what is school choice, will probably elicit a different response depending on who it is you're asking. In light of that, I think it's appropriate that, at least to start this program of discussion, we narrow it down a bit. In 1997, the Pennsylvania legislature passed and Governor Tom Ridge signed Act 22. That paved the way for the establishment of charter schools here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So 21 years later, given what we know now after two decades worth of experience, I'd like to discuss whether public charter schools are doing what they were intended to do. If so, how, and if they've fallen short, how so? Going forward, what can the State Department of Education, the legislature, and local school districts do to improve outcomes and ensure that those outcomes are more equitable for students in both district-run and public charters? Now, that is a more narrow line of discussion, and I don't want to necessarily be limited to it. So to our panelists, in the course of this conversation, if you see an opportunity to incorporate other aspects of the broader school choice debate, then feel free to jump in with that. And to our guests, again, we welcome your questions on this topic and to questions that are germane to the larger discussion of school choice. And we look forward to hearing from you throughout the next hour. Now, to introduce our guests first, Ron Sofo is sitting directly to my left. He is the CEO of City Charter High School here in Pittsburgh, soon to be retired as of the end of this month, as a matter of fact. He's also a former public school superintendent with the Freedom Area School District in Beaver County. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Next, we've got Catherine Augustine. Catherine is the director of the RAND Corporation Pittsburgh office. She's also a senior policy researcher there, focusing on the topic of education. Catherine, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And lastly, we've got Ron Cowell. Ron served in the Pennsylvania legislature from 1975 through 1998. Since leaving the legislature, he's been the president of the Education Policy and Leadership Center, which is based in Harrisburg.
Ron, happy to be here.
Thank you very much. To the three of you, again, thanks for being here. And to start things off, that first question that I alluded to in the introduction, since the passage of the Pennsylvania charter law, how well have charters here in Pennsylvania achieved what they were intended to achieve? So when the law said that the charters are intended to improve pupil learning, that they were intended to increase learning opportunities for all pupils in Pennsylvania, and encourage the use of different and innovative teaching methods in the Commonwealth schools. If you could assign a grade, maybe A through F, for your assessment of that question, how well they've done what they were intended to do, and sort of explain why, I think that'd be a reasonable place to start. So Ron Cowell, if I could throw that to you first.
Well, I'll not assign a grade because I think that would be unfair. We've got more than 150 charter schools around the state. About 16, I think, is the number today of cyber charter schools. The track record among the 150 schools varies tremendously. Some have been around a long time. Some are very new. Some, like the charter school that is headed by our other guest, Ron Sofo, have a good track record, have served students well. And there are other charter schools around the state that have closed, rightfully so. There has been some reporting by other research agencies. We've got one with us today, but a different one, Stanford, that looked at the cyber charter schools and concluded that, generally speaking, it was almost as though the kids didn't go to school. So it really is a mixed picture. From the standpoint of public policy, there were two major purposes, I think, identified by policymakers back in the late 90s. The charter schools were, one, going to create event or options, however you want to characterize it. And on that account, even there, it's been a mixed bag. In Philadelphia, there are lots of options, many, many options. In Pittsburgh, there are some options. In some other areas, there are some charter schools. But there are large regions of the state where there is not a brick-and-mortar charter school. And so that purpose, again, mixed grade there. On the second purpose, that these schools would be laboratories where new things would be tried, lessons would be learned. Those lessons learned and the information attached would be shared with the larger school community, including charter schools, but the larger public school community. Hardly any of that is going on. And that's not to blame the charter schools. They're trying to run schools. During every administration since the Ridge administration, and including the Ridge administration when this law was enacted, there's been a failure on the part of the Department of Education to do a lot of monitoring, a lot of gathering of information, and certainly any reporting and sharing with others. Two caveats there. One, that's not to blame the department per se. The department is terribly understaffed. That's a decision the legislature has made year after year after year, decreasing the complement in the Department of Ed. So there aren't very many bodies to do these things that we say they ought to do and that often the legislature has assigned to them. But then secondly, I know on the Department of Education's website even today, there's a note that soon, I don't think it's up yet, but soon there's going to be some new information added to the website in the Office of Charter Schools now that seems to be a little more robust than it was in recent years. And the promise is that there are going to be some additional resources made available. I think based on maybe some of the lessons learned as well as other technical assistance. So to date, that second purpose has not been fulfilled at all, hardly pursued at all. But I think the current Department of Education is taking it more seriously, and I think we'll see some steps forward.
Catherine, if you'd like to contribute to that.
Sure. Ron, you said a lot, and I happen to agree with everything that you said. I'll just add two points. One is that another goal of the legislation was to, as Ron said, increase innovation and allow these schools to try things that traditional public schools perhaps cannot due to bureaucracy or other reasons. And I do think that they've been successful. Some charter schools have been successful in that regard. And I think that researchers have been able to look across the charter schools that have succeeded across the country and identify some of those practices. Now, the extent to which they've been shared with their fellow public schools, I agree with Ron, not enough of that has happened. And I do think that a way in which the legislation did not succeed is that I do think the way the funding system is set up in Pennsylvania for charter schools does hurt traditional public schools. And I know that there's been a lot of discussion of that, and there are some motions underway to rectify that situation, but I think that's a way in which the legislation has not been successful.
Ron Sofo?
I would agree with the panelists. I think the quality of charter schools is as varied as that of your local neighborhood public schools. I think those that are innovative, some have tried. I do believe that the way we're funded in the state of Pennsylvania makes charter schools and your local neighborhood school district more like enemies than collaborators. And we need to find ways to get over that, because if we're here to service kids and to find the best possible ways, avenues, models to educate all students, we've got to get over those differences and be able to identify best practices. And I'm not here to say that just because you're a charter school, we're doing everything right. But just because we're a neighborhood school, we're not doing everything bad either. How can we take a look and come together for the benefit of all the kids we serve? My school serves 80 to 85% of students in Pittsburgh. We're proud to be part of an effective portfolio of public schools in the city of Pittsburgh. How can we share what we're doing well? How can we talk about our common challenges? And how can we do better for all kids?
You, all three of you mentioned funding there, that there's a problem with the way that the public charter system is funded in this state. I want to dig a little bit deeper into that issue and ask How is the funding system flawed, and in what way does that affect the relationship between the district-run public schools and the public charters?
Well, Chris, I'll take a shot at that because I remember some of what I'll call the faulty thinking of the legislature when the law was enacted. The way charter schools are funded currently is that there is no investment on the part of state government. The costs are paid for entirely by school districts. School districts, by law, are required to write a check for every student who lives within the district but who attends a charter school, whether it's a brick-and-mortar charter school in the district, outside of the district, or it's a cyber charter school somewhere out there in cyberland. The check varies from district to district. It is driven by what a school district is spending on average for each of its own students in the more traditional public schools. There are some things that are backed out. So Ron Sofo knows that it's not 100%. It's probably more like 75 or 80%.
Yes.
But each school district writes a check for each one of those kids driven by the costs for other kids in the school district. What was wrong with that thinking is that the legislature assumed that school districts would save money when a student went off to a charter school. Now, there are two things wrong with that. One, I'm looking at the audience here in the room, and the assumption would be that if one of our audience members would get up and leave, the cost of the lights here, whatever a salary might be attached if he's not a volunteer to the AV man in the back, whatever rent is spent on this place, it's not proportionally reduced because one of the audience members or a student left the classroom. So districts aren't saving money that way. And then secondly, the reality is a lot of the students in charter schools for whom school districts are required to write a check were never in the room to begin with, were never in the school to begin with. They were kids who were homeschooled or maybe were enrolled in a non-public school or maybe came in from Montana or somewhere new to Pennsylvania. So on those two accounts, the thinking was faulty. The legislature began to recognize for about 10 years that the math wasn't working out, the finances weren't working out. And so the legislature until 2011 began to reimburse school districts for up to 30% of the costs that districts incurred in writing those checks for kids in charter schools. Never got to 30%, it was prorated, but it got to 25, 26, 27%. But in 2011, in 2010, it was a $223 million appropriation. In 2011, that was one of the things that was part of the huge cut where school districts lost $854 million. Well, they lost that $223 million that they were being reimbursed in part by the state for charter school expenses as well. So the burden falls on on school districts, and it's exacerbated by the fact that we have the worst K-12 school funding system in the country. The state share is somewhere in the bottom five, somewhere around 35, 36%. We are billions of dollars below where we would be if we were at the national average. And so the poor state support, combined with this extraordinary financial cost to districts and, is incurred because of charter schools, is a pretty onerous burden on many school districts across the state.
So I want to throw it to Ron Sofo here, who has had experience both in the public schools and in the public charters. Mm-hmm. Ron Cowell just laid out there.
What I'd like to say in relation to that. So we pride ourselves that we believe in local control for public education, don't we? But when it came for choice, did any school board member or any school boards vote on that? No. It came from Harrisburg. And did Harrisburg fund it? No. They want choice and quality education in this state on the cheap. You can't have it both ways. I'm tired of seeing systems set up for failure, whether it's your local neighborhood public school or charter public schools. Cost for running schools should be based on audited cost. I have 25 different school districts that feed City Charter High. We don't have 25 different costs for educating a child at City High. The Auditor General has come in. We have outside audits every year from local auditors, Mardusel. We know what it costs. The state should start to own up. If they want quality choice, they should pay their fair share.
Catherine, Augustine, do you have anything to add to that?
The only thing I'll add is that in addition to districts not saving money when they lose students, they're also asked to pay for administrative costs associated with writing the checks to the charter schools, overseeing them to some degree, and that adds additional cost burden to the districts.
So the other part of that question that I wanted to address is, I believe Ron Cowell mentioned the district sees that money leave because the district has to pay the charter school directly. How does that inform the relationship between the public school districts and the public charters? And Catherine, if you want to start us off with that.
I think it turns it into a fairly adversarial relationship, and I see Ron is nodding his head. All of us have said that the original intention to allow these charter schools to develop innovative methods and then share them with their public school counterparts hasn't happened, and I think that's partly why I think there's a lot of animosity between the two sectors.
I would agree. The way we're funded does not promote collaboration, and even when we've tried to say we want to give money back and share in paying for special education costs for students that need to go to special education centers, we can't even get agreement on that. I think the charter schools in the city would be interested in sitting down with the board to say if we've got XYZ, maybe between the five or six brick and mortars, maybe 50 to 70 kids that need transportation, we'd love to pay a prorated amount on district vehicles that are going to the same places, going through the same neighborhoods. We could send back somewhere between $100,000 to $200,000 a year. But because we're, and I'm going to overstate this, because we're the evil charter schools that take money from the district, we don't want to talk to you. Just say no. We're saying no to our kids. We're saying no to taxpayers. We've got to get smart at the local level if we're ever going to have Harrisburg carry their weight. They want us to fight. They don't want quality education for all kids. We've got to get over our adult differences at the local level if we're ever going to have Harrisburg work for us and our children.
Chris, if I could just add, I believe that if we could fix the funding issue and eliminate it as this contentious issue that it is, and really have the state, one, pay a fair share for all school districts, all public schools, and then two, have the state invested in charter school funding in a special way, as it began to be when it was appropriating almost $250 million that then went away, in a lot of places. And I'll set cyber charter schools aside because that's a separate issue. But I believe in a lot of places, the brick and mortar charter schools that are within a district, in a lot of places would be seen as another item, another choice, if you will, on the public school menu. Just as you alluded in your introductory remarks, and I was glad to hear you say that, the choices that affect most of the 2 million students in Pennsylvania are found in our traditional public schools. It is about advanced placement courses. It is about music and education and foreign languages and a host of electives that enrich a curriculum that which are not uniformly available to kids across 500 school districts. But if we could fix this funding issue, I think in places like Philadelphia and probably Pittsburgh and a lot of other places, charter schools would be another opportunity, another option, often providing special curricula opportunities or even special extracurricular opportunities that could be available to students in the district.
So did you want to add something, Catherine?
No,
you did. So the state did recently implement a new fair funding formula, correct? Is that?
They adopted a formula that I've often said, folks who hear me speak have heard me say that my pretty good math grandchild knows that you can have a great formula. If you don't have any money, it doesn't mean anything. So we got a pretty good formula that right now is distributing $500 million a year out of $6 billion. The increment has been $100 million a year. And final comment, my 10-year-old granddaughter, the other granddaughter, She will be 60 years old. This 10-year-old will be 60 years old by the time we get to the point where 50% of the basic education money is going out through this new formula at this current pace of $100 million added a year. That's ridiculous.
That's what I wanted to ask, is whether the new formula in any way alleviates the problems which you're describing, and I'm assuming.
It's a nod in the right direction, but it barely scratches the surface in terms of fixing the problem. The education community that is advocating for a serious fix to this estimates, and I agree with this, you got to add about $3 billion to the pot to fairly fund schools around the state, create some equity across 500 districts, and have the state pay a fair share.
So that'd be having the state shoulder more of the burden, is what you're describing. So do we have a question now, Sarah? Does anybody have a question they'd like to?
Well, I kind of have two. The first one is about the funding, and we talk about the idea of charters being as innovation labs and then sharing best practices. How about for funding? Are there states around the country that have already figured this issue out, and can we look at those as best practices for maybe informing our policy in Pennsylvania? And the second is the idea of the local districts being the authorizing agent for charters. Does that also need to change? Does that add to the adversarial relationship, or if we handle the funding, do you think that that idea of local districts being the authorizing agent and then having to manage the charters as well, would that be okay, or should that change as well?
I'll start. There are certainly other models throughout the country. There are states in which a city can charter a school, or a county, or a university. California probably has the most liberal policies, and they have the most charter schools of any state in the country. There are some interesting things happening in other places. Indiana also has a large number of charter schools proportionately, and they've developed in Indianapolis something called innovation schools, where the charter schools are now actually part of the district and part of their portfolio. But they're managed by a charter organization, and that's an attempt to more easily share innovation back and forth between the charter school and the district school. And the district then claims the outcomes from that school as their student outcomes. It has some ability to transfer students in and out and save money and share costs across those charters and the district school. So I think that's an interesting model to think about, whether or not in Pennsylvania if schools could be chartered in another way and the funding problem could be fixed. I do think that that might help alleviate some of the adversarial relationships that we see. I don't know if it would help the kids or improve education overall.
First, if you would not fix the funding issue and simply take authorization away from the districts, I think you make the problem even worse, because districts will be in a position where they're writing checks for a large number of students who live in their district, and they have no responsibility, no say at all in terms of approving the charter or monitoring it. So I don't think that's a good fix, absent dealing with the money issue. Secondly, even if you deal with the money issue and you take the local district out of the picture, then I think you probably erode or diminish the possibility of the collaborative approach that I think Ron and both of the Rons here would argue to be most desirable. Mm-hmm. I think we ought to figure out how to enhance the relationship, treat those charter schools in the district as part of that public school menu, but seriously fix the funding problem. That seems to be the core of the bad relationships in a lot of places right now.
Ron Sofo, do you have anything to add to that?
No.
Okay. So it seems like the funding issue is at the root of a lot of this. What sort of appetite is there to really, buckle down and fix this issue in the legislature? Ron, you work out of Harrisburg.
The we didn't talk specifically about the special education funding piece of this, but that seems to be the most contentious. I mean, there are a number of reports, including those from the State Auditor General, that suggest that charter schools are overpaid for kids with special needs. And that determination is based on the information that says that charter schools have a lesser percentage of kids with extraordinary and extraordinarily costly special needs than you find in the total school population. Yet they are paid for special education costs based on a school district's expenses that include all the kids with special needs, those that have modest needs as well as those that are most expensive. So by that kind of calculation, it's argued that many charter schools are being overpaid. There seems to be some consensus about that issue in Harrisburg, yet no appetite or no ability so far to step in and fix it. But if there's any low-hanging fruit on this issue of funding, that would seem to be the low-hanging fruit. But again, to date, the legislature has failed to act on that issue over 2, 3, 4 years now.
Go ahead.
I'd like to add to that just a little bit, Ron. Special ed is mandated at many different levels. I don't disagree that there's some charter schools that are taking more money in than they're spending. To me, the direct way is, so how much money are you spending? How many kids do you have? What are you spending on those IEPs? Pay us for the audited cost. And here's where I'm going to go. The federal government passed IDEA back in the 70s. They're lucky if they ever funded that at the federal level more than 18%. Everybody wants to get away on the cheap. Let's take a look at what we're really spending and then decide what the equitable share needs to be at the local, state, and federal level. The reason they don't do that is because we know what the math would say, and we as adults would have to own up and make some hard choices. So they move the pieces around the chessboard, and they get us again to fight with each other for the crumbs and will not take a look at the hard numbers of what. I'll open my books, come and take a look at what we spend for the number of kids that we have, and take a look at the IEPs from speech to those that we have that we can't provide equitable supports in the building. Let's take a look at that. Let's figure out what we're spending. I don't want to make money on any child. Public education should not be for profit, should not be for a cost plus. But still, the legislature will not put the mirror up to themselves and own the cost for quality, equitable education for all kids. If you have money, you can go move to where you want and get the education that you believe is going to be good. But if you don't have money, no, we're not going to fix it and increase the probability that every child's going to have an equitable shot at a quality education. We're just going to keep stirring the pot and getting us to fight at the local level. Stop it. When are we as adults at the local level going to hold people in the policy world responsible?
Now, Chris, just to add to what Ron Sofo has said, there's a side of me that says I'm feeling bad about piling on the state in particular here, but it is deserved. Since 1991, when the way that we fund special education in Pennsylvania got changed, mm-hmm. there's been a shift from state responsibility to school district responsibility of more than $1 billion a year. That's in part how the state has managed to balance budgets and not increase taxes that they brag about. In the last 10 years, in terms of special education costs, the state appropriation went from $1.01 billion, where it stood for 6 consecutive years, to barely $1.1 billion now, a $100 million increase. During that 10-year period, the cost for special education incurred by school districts went up by more than $500 million. So we continue to see the state shift to local school districts and local taxpayers the responsibility for special education in particular, along with the rest of K-12 costs.
This is a special 90.5 WESA presentation of a community forum on school choice. The forum is moderated by WESA's Christopher Ayers. The panelists are Ron Sofo, president and CEO of City Charter High School, Ron Cowell, president of the Education Policy and Leadership Center, Catherine Augustine, director of the RAND Corporation's Pittsburgh office and an education policy researcher. We now rejoin their conversation.
So I think we want to get to a question here in the audience real quick.
Hi, I'm Pamela Harbin. I am a parent of 2 children in Pittsburgh Public Schools. One of those boys has a disability, and I am a past co-chair of the local task force for the right to education. My question is about the student population. When you look at student populations in public schools and charter schools, they don't match. Charter schools don't take kids or don't educate kids with that are English language learners. They don't educate kids with disabilities, Ron, as you were saying, at the same rates as public schools do for specific disabilities like autism and intellectual disabilities and emotional disturbance. So I've heard Mr. Sofo say a couple times in this thing that there are kids that you just can't serve and need to be somewhere else. Is that okay? Should we allow that?
Pam, in the Pittsburgh public schools, a local neighborhood public school can't always provide in Pittsburgh what a child needs, and they have centers to which they send them. You're creating a false dichotomy here. That's a half-truth. That is a half-truth. We have 21% students with IEPs. Parents choose us. We turn no one away. For you to say that for City High is inaccurate and not truthful for all schools. Don't paint all charters with the same brush, just like it's not fair to paint all neighborhood public schools with the same brush. It's not. I have intellectual disabilities, autistic kids across the spectrum. I have kids who have emotional disturbance. So your perception is inaccurate based upon the facts. Maybe as a whole, but not by individual school building.
How much you spend, so it's between $25,000.
I'm getting too old to remember those numbers.
Yeah,
but it is a lot.
You can look
right for
each charter school how much money they have for each of those disability cost categories. And your charter school does not have kids in those categories.
Parents choose us. We don't turn anyone away. For you to say that is inaccurate.
If I can add my 2 cents, I probably ought to just be quiet about it, but I think that charter schools don't turn kids away because legally they can't. Legally, they're required to offer services to kids or to accept all kids. But I think Ron Sofo is correct. I don't know about his school in particular, but I'm talking about statewide. Parents take a look around, and just as they choose school districts based on the services available, they may decide to not send their son or daughter to a charter school because of the services that are available. And so, you know, they end up going back to the school district, and the school district may send them to a center or IU or wherever it might be. The big difference is that the charter schools are still getting reimbursed. As I said earlier, this is being redundant now, they're getting reimbursed on the basis of the numbers that the school district is spending for all of those kids. I think that's what really needs to be argued about and fixed by law, where the dollars go. The law is clear that charters must accept all kids who choose to go there. But I'd hate to characterize any school leader, school educator, but if some charter school folks are candid with parents who are coming and asking, can my son or daughter be well served here? Here's what we have. And the parent makes the judgment about whether that's adequate or not, whether they're going to pick that place or look somewhere else.
Okay. My name is John McCann. I'm the CEO of the Environmental Charter School. Magnets and charters in the city of Pittsburgh have long waiting lists. Parents clearly want these options. Question to any panelist, how can we expand quality public choices in the city of Pittsburgh?
Whoever would like to take that?
I'm not one to speak for the public school district in Pittsburgh, but one, let me acknowledge I don't know whether you're still housed in the same place there in Regent Square, but that was part of my legislative district, and you folks were getting started, I think, just shortly after I left the legislature, but that's been I cite it often over more than 10 years now, 15 years, as an example of a charter school with a particular emphasis that can be a valuable piece of a public school menu. In your case, the emphasis on environment. In some other cases, the emphasis on the arts or music or whatever it might be. To some degree, I think it's a matter of or to a significant degree, I think it's a matter of fixing the funding problem that we've been talking about for the last 30 minutes now. School districts, I think, will be more welcoming to charter schools, magnet schools, whatever the governance structure and the educational structure might be. They're going to be more welcoming and more financially capable of accommodating those choices when we fix some of the school funding problem. Now, the fact is the Pittsburgh School District is a relatively high spending school district in contrast to some other urban districts around the state, i.e. Philadelphia. There's no real comparison between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. Philadelphia spends a lot more less, or let me say a lot less per child, per student, than is the case in Pittsburgh. But at the end of the day, it comes down to resources, it comes down to priorities, I think it's also fair to say it comes down to, you know, who gets elected. These school board members don't get appointed, except in Philadelphia, but we elect school board members in 499 districts around the state. And I tip my hat to anybody who's willing to stick their neck out, put their name on the ballot, and run for school board. These are thankless positions. They're unpaid. They spend enormous hours, and they, in my opinion, are the most powerful decision makers in the state because nine of them, it's unilateral. It's not bicameral. There's no executive to veto what they do. And collectively, they spend about $28 billion a year in this state. So we ought to pay closer attention to the folks that we elect to school boards in our 499 districts where we have elections. I think that's an important part of the answer to the question you raise.
I want to add to that just a bit, and this does relate to funding. Some of the things that some charter schools do across the country that have been identified as good practices do require additional funding. And one of those practices is something that the Environmental Charter School does do, and that is having extended learning time for kids. So if you look at KIPP schools, some of the charter schools in the Harlem Children's Zone, Achievement First Schools in New York City, all schools that outperform their local public schools, two things that they tend to do is intense after-school tutoring and extended time on task. The KIPP schools are open until 6 p.m. They have Saturday school. They have summer school. Those things cost additional money, and it's not something that an average or typical public school can do. But it seems to be making a difference. And if there was additional funding and schools had the will to spend more time with kids and provide intense tutoring and mentoring, that could make a difference in terms of improving quality across schools. And some of the other things that the charter schools do, like set high expectations for children, provide frequent feedback to kids, use data in making decisions about instruction, those kinds of things do happen in all schools and can happen in all schools and don't require extra funding. But some of the other things that take place outside of the traditional school day are expensive.
Chris, I'd like to ask a question of our other two panelists.
Sure, absolutely.
They may have some good insight to this. 20 years ago, when the charter school law was being debated, one of the most hotly debated issues was what kind of waivers ought to be made available to charter schools so that they could be innovative, operate in a different way. And the most hotly debated waiver was about the authority to be given to charter schools to have a significant percentage of their staff not have the usual certificates. And the law said that you could have up to 25% of your staff without the usual teaching certificates. Mm-hmm. My sense is that as contentious as that was 20 years ago, in almost all instances, all teachers have the appropriate or the usual certification. And a lot of the charter schools that are advertising brag about 100% of our staff are certified. So what was thought to be an important waiver and was thought to be an important threat seems to have become a non-issue. Do you read it differently?
No, I would agree with that. I hear from my public school colleagues that we have an advantage, and the advantage isn't that we hire a ton of uncertified teachers. We don't. We pride ourselves. We want our students to experience certified teachers in the state of Pennsylvania. What I think gets to the crux or another angle is I'm told over and over again, well, you have an advantage as a charter school because people choose you. Well, if choice is so powerful, then let's open up the whole city and let parents choose what school they want to go to. Because if that means that they're invested more in their child's education in the place that they think programmatically or otherwise they're going to get a best fit, and I would say this, whatever charters are allowed to do now as a superintendent, we should have for our local neighborhood public schools the same ability for each one of those schools to do the same things. There should be no restriction. If charter schools are operating and those that have quality, and I'll say this, charter schools have a higher accountability because if kids don't come to us, we don't operate. We don't operate. And Pittsburgh knows when you had to downsize because of enrollment, that's painful to close a school, right? Painful. And politically, as board members, you pay prices. But every year, if we don't make enrollment quotas, we don't exist. So there's a higher level of some ways of accountability in a charter environment. And if choice is really that key, and having all the variations or the ability to have waivers across the board that charters have, I would promote that all neighborhood public schools operate, we all operate by the same rules, and including choice.
Hi, my name is Maggie. I'm a staff member at the Three Rivers Village School. You've touched on this already a bit, but I'm curious, what are some of the innovations that charter schools are putting into practice and supposed to be sharing with public schools that makes this, like, choice?
I'll talk a little bit because I think we're a good example. All right, at the high school, D's aren't passing, and our C isn't the old D with lipstick on it. And I'm not saying we're a perfect school, but I'll ask anybody out here, who wants to work for D wages? Who wants to work and live in a D house? That's one thing, tip of the iceberg, policy-wise, in the state of Pennsylvania, across the country. If you want to improve public education, D's got to go. The new C, the C can't be the old D, but you've got to agree to equitable supports, and that costs money. Two, our teachers, there's built-in response, professional responsibility for results. All of our core teachers, math, science, English, social studies, information literacy, stay with kids for 4 years. So your math teacher in ninth grade is your math teacher in 12th grade. So if the students aren't getting it, there's a beeline of accountability. Oh, but that's not the only reason we do that. We don't teach subjects, we teach kids. Relationships matter. Particularly at the adolescent age, we've got to develop caring relationships and invest in the humans that we teach and get to see and know them as real human beings. Two, competency-based promotion. We don't give major raises just because you sat in a seat for 15, 20, 30 years. We have four steps, apprentice, journeyman, expert, ed leader, and there's 12 to 22 different competencies at either the proficient or the advanced level, and when you jump between those levels, there's pay increases of $10,000 to $15,000. We teach a financial literacy curriculum. We teach a career curriculum for 3 years. All of our students have internships in a place of work that relates to their career interest, and if they don't perform out in the world of work, they don't graduate. Every kid gets a laptop. That's old. We got to update that, but we infuse the use of that laptop into learning. Plus, when we teach technology, we teach the industry-based standards of Microsoft, Adobe, and they earn national certifications. I could go on and on, but those are some core things that make a difference at City High that aren't happening in most public high schools to the degree and in totality, because not one of those practices is going to make a difference. It's how they all come together to support the child. Oh, we have two full-time social workers for 600 kids. We have a full-time nurse. We have two full-time internship coordinators that look for 150 internship placements every year. We have two full-time post-high school planners that work with parents and kids to make sure they have a plan A and a plan B, whether that's to go in the military, whether that's to work, or to go to college. We have four librarians, no library. We teach information literacy in the digital age, and I'll stop right there.
I think we have another question here from the audience.
Yes, so I have a couple of questions. For Mrs. Augustine to answer your question, many of the schools in our area, public schools, the Pittsburgh public schools, actually do have extended time. That extended time lasts until 6, and we also have Saturday school. And I can say that because as a former principal, that's exactly what I had. And I could say my other colleagues had that same activity. One of the things that you haven't talked about is race. And it also encompasses the formula as well. In Pittsburgh, we had a charter school that applied to us that also applied to one of our neighboring suburban school districts. The suburban school district denied the charter. However, when we denied the charter for the same reasons, it was overturned. We had to allow the charter to evolve within Pittsburgh. So race becomes a major component to this question of choice. Is it really choice of getting a better education, or is it a choice that you don't want to be around African-American students, children with that are English language learners, or students that have multiple handicaps that we have to take and we want to take? Don't, as a school board member right now, I'm telling you, that is not, we're going to take them. So the next question I have is, we have children that are a part of the city that become homeless, they are foster care children. Do they get an opportunity to have this choice? Because they don't have anybody advocating for them. There's no parent out there right now that's trying to say, I want my child to have X, Y, and Z. What they want is someplace to have their child go to school. So let's expand the talk to include the children who are really out there that you're saying we want to help every child, and there's choice, but I'm wondering who's the choice really for.
Catherine Augustine, if you'd like to.
Sure, speak. I'll comment.
My name is Regina Hawley, and I am the school board president for the Pittsburgh Public Schools.
Thank you, Dr. Hawley. I was going to mention that the Pittsburgh Public Schools have introduced community schools, and even prior to that, there were schools that were open on Saturdays and open until 6, and I think that's great. In terms of race, that's a good question. When we look nationally at charter school attendance compared to kids across the country, yes, there are more minority students by percentage in charter schools than live in this country, and that is primarily because there are more charter schools in urban centers. So when we look in within an urban center, whether it's New York City or Boston or Chicago, we don't see that there are more students of color in the charter schools than in the public schools. But that said, we don't look at other characteristics. We, meaning the research field, does not look at other characteristics of students. So I can't say whether there are the same proportion of homeless students attending charter schools as traditional public schools. I would doubt it. And I do think that's something that researchers and practitioners alike worry about, are parents who don't make choices for whatever reason, whether it's because they're homeless or for another reason, are they being left behind while other motivated parents are making choices to leave a public school, which then makes it harder to educate the students who are in that school. I think that's a valid concern.
Ron Sofo, would you like to speak to that at all? Does the current charter system do a bad job or a not adequate job of reaching out to at-risk students who might not have a parent present? Or
I think you need to take a look at school by school. I would agree that based upon the fact that there's an application process that's required, and if you're homeless or you come from an at-risk family, you're probably less likely to be able to access that, and that's part of the current rules. I agree with Dr. Hawley that public education should be for all kids, including charter schools. However, some of the, again, admissions requirements, if you're at an at-risk family, but I can tell you this, depending upon the day at City High, we have anywhere from 2 to 5 kids that are homeless. depending upon the day at City High, we have every year 1 to 5 kids that are in foster care. Do we go and seek them out? Do we go and tell them not to come? No. Whoever chooses us, we have human services, social agencies that know us and recommend kids that are in the system to come to us. Now, at the same frequency as your local neighborhood public school? No, I agree. I do not disagree with that, because you're a system with multiple schools and we're one school. Again, how can we learn from each other? How can we make it better? I'm not going to sit here on a high horse and say, we got all the answers. I think working together, we can solve the problems and the concerns that at this point we think divide us for the benefit of all kids. However, I would agree that how the enrollment process for charter schools does not make it easy and is a bigger hurdle for those at-risk populations to access the charter environment. And that's something I'm open to taking a look at. It should be easier.
Let me respond to a couple points you raised. One, your earlier comment about an appeal was made in the Pittsburgh instance and not in the suburban. Was that Propel by any chance?
No.
Okay. Because I know they've got a presence in many different communities. I don't know the detail, but it might have been they simply didn't appeal the decision made in the suburban district. They appealed the decision in the Pittsburgh district. And they appealed both?
Yes.
And so you got two different decisions out of the state appeal board.
Yes.
That's unusual, but I don't know the circumstances. But you raise a couple of other really important issues that ought to be underscored. First, in terms of the homeless kids, we have 20,000 kids who are homeless in Pennsylvania. And until the federal law changed a couple years ago, these kids were under the radar in many places all over the state and all over the nation, really. There's still probably a huge undercount in Philadelphia, because right now Pittsburgh has, I think, more identified homeless kids than does the city of Philadelphia, which is 10 times larger. So it says something about the responsibility of districts that now under federal law have a responsibility to find these kids and educate them, even if they're moving around. So that's an important element that you raise. And then certainly kids who are in foster homes. We've got in many areas of the state a fairly active CASA program, court-appointed advocates for these kids. But in a lot of places, we don't have that kind of advocacy for these kids as well. So you touch the surface of a lot of groups of kids who need better advocacy. The final thing I would note, because you note this issue of treating kids of color differently. Ron Sofa went through a leadership program that my organization has annually. Another person who went through it is Erica Frankenberg, who's a professor up at Penn State, who is a nationally recognized author and expert now on the resegregation of America's schools. And we all ought to pay a lot of attention to the research and the conclusions that Erica is reaching about this really important issue. And consider, are charter schools contributing to the problem, helping to solve the problem? I don't think there's a single answer, because as we tried to emphasize, it's a different picture from community to community and state to state. But that needs to be an important part of the conversation.
I've got a question here in the audience.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and my question goes back to, we touched on your teachers and how innovation. So what, in your opinion, do you think needs to change in the teacher preparatory programs in a higher ed level? How do you encourage a teacher to come to, say, your school versus everyone's pie-in-the-sky dream of working in the public school system? And how do you bring young teachers up and encourage them to be more innovative and not worry so much about what the public school is asking them, your tests, and you're worrying about making sure that all your kids read at a certain level. When you're concerned about that, you lose the innovation. So do you have any sort of working relationships with higher ed? And if so, what's working?
We've tried, but we haven't been successful. I think the model, particularly for urban ed, needs to be, I would say, distinctly different than what we've been used to in traditional teacher education for many years here. You know, we've reached out and tried to say that we'd like to find institutions of higher education that would partner with us or with any urban school and try to get young people in their junior and senior year to do internships and become what I would call teaching assistants, and with the understanding that in their undergraduate years, they would focus on a content, whether it's social studies, whether it's math, whether it's special ed, all right? But then have at least 1 to 2 years of graduate work where they're actually working with what I would call a master or educational leader teacher that would really help form and shape them day to day for the whole school year. But that takes money, because you can't ask college students to work for peanuts. And the other side of that equation goes to, we pay teachers on the cheap overall in this country. There's been a number of studies that have come out recently that anywhere from 10, 20 to 25%, if you look across the country, you know, in the state of Pennsylvania, we probably pay in the top five. But across the country, if you go to Oklahoma, if you go down to the South, if you go Virginia, we've had teachers come back to City High who've gone to the Carolinas, Florida, Virginia, because of the pay. And when they see what we're doing and how we do it, they're invigorated. But I do believe that our partners in higher ed need to be willing to take some risks and be innovative, and we need to fund a more like a four-year program that starts in junior senior year of college and ends up with 2 years of really guided practice under experts in the urban environment. And it's just not the content. It's about equity. It's about culturally responsive teaching practices and pedagogy. It's about understanding City High. I'll tell you this. We got one of the most equitable models of delivering a high school education, but guess what? We're 98% white in our teaching staff. If we don't accept that we've got biases or blind spots with a student population that's between 50 and 54% African American, we're kidding ourselves. We're trying to move that needle. I think that's an area that, as a charter school and as the city of Pittsburgh, we need to cooperate on. There's things that I know are being done in the Pittsburgh Public Schools that could help City High and the kids that we serve and vice versa. Let's make it a win-win. But short answer, we want teachers on the cheap. Stop it. Do we really care about our kids?
If you or any of your other listeners want to do a little more homework on this, one, recognize we're getting to the point where we're going to have a teacher shortage in Pennsylvania, unlike anything we've experienced for 40, 50 years. The number of enrollees in teacher prep programs is down by 50%. Number of new certificates went in a three-year period from 16,000 to 6,000. And our record in terms of teachers of color is worse than it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we did a report with EPLC that said we were at 4% and miserable. We're worse now than we were 10 years ago. There are some initiatives coming out of the Pennsylvania Department of Education, including a teacher residency program that involves three higher education institutions this year. And just a few days ago, I heard Secretary Rivera say that that program is being expanded to a larger number of post-secondary institutions in the coming year. So I don't know if it's on their website right now, but it's a teacher residency program funded by the Pennsylvania Department of Education with dollars going to some partner higher education institutions. You might want to do a little homework and find that.
This has been a special presentation from 90.5 WESA on school choice and charter schools. The forum was held at the Pittsburgh Community Broadcast Center on Tuesday, September 18th. It was moderated by WESA's Christopher Ayers, and it was edited for Time.